The booster dose, the best way to stay protected longer. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening and welcome to AmanLa, 1 hour of African current affairs and analysis brought to you on CQT 90.3 FM here in Montreal and CQT.ca around the world. Doug and I are sitting in our virtual, well, in our homes, which have become our virtual studios for the production of AmanLa. Doug, you have a nice show lined up, so let us know what's going on.
Well, Gwen, two things. We've been getting some marvelous resources together from friends and comrades and the connections. Yassine Mansour has sent us a link to a book launch in South Africa, The Red Road to Freedom, The History of the South African Communist Party. So I'm going to play a little part of the book launch that Yassine pointed out to us. It's an important and significant party and an important time in their history as well. And secondly, we're going to play a second part, two more interviews from the Guerrilla Africa-China panel that was held two Sundays ago, and which I think really contained some wonderful insights. Many mistruths and misinformations were corrected, and a whole other perspective painted of that relationship. And it was held by Guerrilla, Group for Research and Initiatives for Liberation of Africa in Toronto, with our old comrade Amet Lowe as the chairperson. So stay tuned to AmanLa.
Tina wabon kondo sismisele, huku wabulala, wana amabulu. Amba gase mkondo, we mkondo, mkondo we sise. Amba gase mkondo, we mkondo, mkondo we sise. Tina wabon kondo sismisele.
As I said earlier, friends and comrades, ladies and gentlemen, the new book, Red Road to Freedom, A History of the South African Communist Party, has been produced in South Africa by Jacana Press. And they had a panel, of course. It is a book launch, because that's how we're doing it these days in the way days of COVID and Zoom. And the author, Tom Lodge, and three contributors were interviewed about it. We don't have time for the whole panel to play, but we're going to play Tom Lodge's introduction to the book and the issues, and Jeremy Cronin, a longtime standing member of the South African Communist Party. And now I find this very important because in 1961, December 16th, is the 60th anniversary of the founding of Mkhonto we Sizwe, MK as it came to be known, which is the spear of the nation, and that was the armed wing of the African National Congress, for the freedom fighters, for the freedom struggle of South Africa, to go hand in hand at the four-part strategy of public education and mobilization of the people locally, international competition and contestation, protests at inside the country. But then, because of the problems of dealing with the hard-nosed apartheid regime, armed struggle became an inevitable fourth arm of the struggle. So this is the 60th anniversary of the founding. And why that's important is because SACP, South African Congress Communist Party members, were instrumental both in setting up Mkonto and leading it throughout. Even before the setting up of Mkonto, communists had already undertaken sabotage campaigns, and long before 61, the Communist Party had been banned. So they had led a brilliant and powerful underground struggle, had honed their skills, and they became very much the backbone of Mkonto. So I'm very pleased to introduce you to the history of that party, the South African Communist Party. So listen to Tom Lodge and Jeremy Cronin.
So we'll start off with Tom, and in many respects, Tom, as with all of our panelists, need little introduction, I'm sure, to most of the people in the audience. But for those of you who may not be aware of Tom's background, he is a Professor Emeritus of Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Limerick, and also is Honorary Professor of Development Studies at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. He was formerly a member of staff in the Political Studies Department at Wits University between 1978 and 2005, and has written a huge number of really significant and important books on South African political history, including Black Politics in South Africa since 1945, Critical Life of Mandela, published in 2006, and Sharpeville, an Apartheid Massacre and Its Consequences, published in 2011. So without further ado, I will talk to Tom, who will provide us with a kind of context and framework and overview of his book over the next 10 minutes. So over to you, Tom. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Robert. And I should say right at the outset, a couple of thank yous. If this was a conventional launch, one would spend half the time saying thank you to people. But that's not what you all took time off this afternoon to listen to. But I should actually thank both Robert and Ariana for organizing this session. And of course, all of you, including my fellow panelists, but those of you who are here listening at this very moment, for taking the time to do this. Until recently, just living to 100 was an achievement worth celebrating for itself. In England, as you all know, new centenarians receive a special card from their queen. And perhaps the same convention is maintained in South Africa, and the party's 400,000 or so members can expect a birthday message from Cyril Ramaphosa, or maybe not. But in any case, these people have more to celebrate than their party's extreme old age. Though under the very tough conditions in which the party has existed, survival itself is an achievement, because next to the ANC, the South African Communist Party is the oldest political organization in Africa that still exists. But South African communists did more than outlive their rivals and their opponents. I argue in my book that they can make very strong claims to have shaped South African history decisively. Now, I'm not going to go into these arguments in any great detail, but I should just refer to them at least in outline. Which ways have the South African communists impacted on their country's history? Well, first of all, they initiated political solidarities that cut across South Africa's racial and social cleavages. And they began doing this from the party's formation in 1921. When it began recruiting Black South Africans. The point here, by the way, that's part of an auto-critique, if you like, of the book, is in the book I rely very heavily on autobiographical writing by South African communists. But in the way that these things happen, much of that writing is by white South African communists, and there's still a shortage, though it's a shortage that is less acute now than used to be the case, of confessional writing by Black South African politicians and Black South African left-wing politicians in particular. 10 years later, after 1921, there were Black people leading the party and joining it in thousands. And the party's commitment to cross-racial politics, it wavered every now and then, but even so, it supplied real world evidence that Black and white South Africans could share political goals and work towards them together. In the early 1930s, as early as 1931, the first white communists were convicted and served prison sentences for sedition, that is, for attempting to mobilize black followers. Today, in South Africa, communists can take a considerable portion of the credit for the extent to which the country's politics are non-racial. Secondly, in terms of shaping South African history, modern South Africa has one of the strongest labour movements in the developing world, a movement that still, to a certain extent, shapes government policy. Now, the historical gestation of this movement, it's a very complicated story. And communists were not by no means the only labour pioneers. But in the early 1930s and 1940s, people like the recently disembarked Lithuanian immigrant Ray Alexander assembled industrial unions that would constitute enduring foundations for what was to follow. Some of today's most powerful trade unions can trace their genealogy back to her efforts in particular. Communists in the 1940s, such as the Port Elizabeth dry cleaning worker Raymond Plummer, worked out a strategy of alliances beginning with community protests to support strike movements. And this coalition between labor leaders and community activists would persist through the next five decades, helping to enable national liberation in 1994. Now, in fact, at a local level, trade unionists were community leaders in the 1940s, as well as belonging to the Communist Party. And in the vicinities in which they were busiest, in New Brighton, for example, in the townships dispersed along the East Rand, or in Cape Town's Langa, these leaders and their activist communist following in the 1950s, after the party's prohibition, continue to organize and mobilize. And it's no coincidence that where the ANC had the most entrenched and systematic presence in the 50s, it was in the localities in which communists were best organized in the 1940s. In short, the decade of defiance of the 50s, that in many ways provided a kind of template and source of inspiration for the mass defiance of the 1980s, the decade of defiance in the 1950s was incubated in party networks. Now, there are many other ways, and I detail them in the book, in which the party stamped its historic imprint. If the armed struggle was decisive, it was certainly important in inspiring other kinds of political action during the 80s, then communists supplied many of the key members of its general staff and field commands. Communists also played an important role, though it's one that I think is still, even after the work that I did on it in the book, a role about which one can ask questions. Communists played an important role in coordinating and developing some of the internal political activity of the 80s as well. From the 1920s onwards, through its night schools and other training facilities, the party educated successive echelons of South Africans' political leadership. That the ANC today, in its internal discourses, still uses the jargon, the language, the phraseology, the lexicon employed by the party's commissars in the Angolan training camps 40 years ago is testimony to their enduring effectiveness as educators. Earlier than any other South African political movement, the Communist Party brought women into leadership. And the pioneers whom the party should be recalling on its birthday include key women, Rebecca Bunting, Josiane Palmer, and I'm delighted to see that up with us today is the author of a wonderful new biography of Josiane Palmer, Bob Edgar, Molly Walton, Dora Tamana, Betty Du Toit, Ruth First. Is it just history, though, that the party is celebrating this year? What about today and recent events? Communists have held important positions in ANC governments for nearly 30 years. They can count their membership today in hundreds of thousands, not just hundreds. But are they still shaping history? South African communists argue that their participation in government makes a real difference, reinforcing its commitment to public employment programs, to reindustrialization, to better foreign trade policies, to increased financial aid for students. And I'm sure the list is much longer. But they also concede that much of their effort is undone by political corruption and bureaucratic inefficiency, that they've failed to shift the government's neoliberal macroeconomic policies significantly. They do suggest that they play a role in limiting public venality, and this may be true, though initially they helped to defend President Zuma against his critics, as well as contributing to his victory at Polokwane. Does their membership really matter? The party's following doesn't constitute a disciplined electoral bloc, either within the ANC's own internal voting procedures, nor in national or municipal polls. Nor is it a membership that draws solidarity from its participation in manufacturing in the classic Marxian sense. One of the largest social groups from whom the party recruits today is young unemployed people, a group that keeps growing, sadly. The party's present strategic purpose is about building capacity for socialism. And in following this course, it's fair to say that its present challenges are as formidable as anything it's confronted in the past. Because then arguably South Africa's developmental trajectory, its history as an industrializing country was on the party's side. Today, I think things are much more uncertain. And the history that I was writing is still a history that's still being made.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your comments. We will now turn to Jeremy Cronin, who has a kind of a long history of activism and and membership of the South African Communist Party. Jeremy was part of the was elected to the Central Committee of the South African Communist Party in 1989. Was part of the South SACP delegation to CODESA negotiations and joint draft coordinator of the RDP. He then went on to be Deputy General Secretary of the SACP from 1995 to 2017, and has served as ANC NEC member from 1991 until 2012. You've been an ANC party MP until 2019, from 1989 to 2019, and Deputy Minister from 2009 and up to 2019. And you are currently the South African Communist Party Central Committee, South African Communist Party Central Committee and Political Bureau member. So thank you so much for participating, for joining. And I also know that you've been a key contributor in to Tom's research process. So thanks so much for joining us. And I'll hand over to you now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robert. And greetings to my fellow panelists. And let me begin where Paolo began, which is to really congratulate Tom for, I think, what is a landmark scholarly achievement in dealing with 100 years and more, because you obviously also trace the early beginnings of the Communist Party in South Africa. Maybe I'll touch on some of it largely in agreement with what Paolo has said, but let me begin with where I was wanting to begin, which was that to say that clearly the central theme, and I think that was said again in his brief introductory remarks, Tom's brief introductory remarks, is the hugely important, significant influence of the Communist Party on Black liberation struggles, particularly from 1945 going forward, and especially obviously on the ANC. And in doing this, on the one hand, Tom corrects and says so, and I think correctly so, a tendency in some of the earlier deep scholarly research, like the Karras and Carter volumes, which are, you know, huge and very useful resource, obviously, from protest to challenge, that the role of the party in this period, 1945 through, tends to be a bit diminished, but not significantly noticed. And as Tom correctly says in his writing, this is partly the result of the absence of resources which have now become available with the opening of Comintern archives, hundreds of largely, yes, unfortunately, white communist doing their autobiographies and biographies and so forth. But also, as I think he correctly suggests, these were liberal friends of the ANC, and it was good to have any kind of friend in that period. But we're not inclined really to look at the influence of the Communist Party and inclined to believe that the ANC had an independence which would make it largely waterproof to a communist influence. But on the other hand, in order to argue for this significant impact of the Communist Party, theoretically, but also in terms of organization and mobilization, he also obviously doesn't stray in the direction of the Cold War warriors, scholar journalists like R.W. Johnson and Stephen Ellis, who turn the party's impact and influence on the ANC into a kind of manipulative entryism on behalf of Kremlin bosses, essentially. That was obviously a line taken by the apartheid regime for all the obvious reasons, but was also basically developed in a much more sophisticated way by people like Stephen Ellis. I think Tom very usefully, picks a very useful and I think constructive way through those two extremes. And I think a lot has to do with what I find amongst the most interesting things about Tom's approach to this history. And it's his interest in the sociology of the party, if I could call it that. And despite the party's often proclaimed pretensions or aspirations to be a vanguard Leninist democratic centralist formation, which it's sometimes been, I guess, but often it's not that. And I think it has to do with this interesting, complex internal sociology of the party, which has to do with many things. The first obvious thing would be its non-racial diversity from its very beginnings. And as Paul has correctly stressed, and I think Tom also does, it was not a non-racialism that was perfect and needed to grapple with the realities. I mean, there's that wonderful phrase that you've got his name's escaped me, I shouldn't, the first chairperson of the Communist Party in South Africa, whose inclinations, psychological habits and so on were with a white industrial working class, but who theoretically could accept that proletarians also might be black. There's this ethnic and racial diversity of the Communist Party, which is quite unique. But also there are these profound gaps in time, periods in which the party is growing and periods in which the party is stagnating or is deeply involved in fragmentation and early 1930s internecine factionalism and so forth, which then create interesting gaps. So I think for me, one of the interesting gaps, which also then relates to spatial distances and diaspora, very marked, obviously, during the period mid-1960s through the 70s and 80s, when the key party leadership is in exile. But even more interestingly, and that comes through well in stuff that Ariana Lissoni has written, but also in Tom Lodge's book, there are two centers, actually, two SACP centers, with the non-African party leadership unable in the late 60s and first half of the 70s to base in Africa and therefore form around a London center, with the general secretary and chairperson of the party, Africans based in Dar es Salaam, and two quite distinct cultures and tensions start to develop inside of the party, with those in London believing that the African party leadership has become more ANC than party. And I'm sure the alternative view was that, they were risking the importance, the critical importance at the time, which it certainly was, of rebuilding a fractured and dispersed ANC. And that being too communist in that space, was risking. So I think more could have been made of some of the other divisions, and particularly what opened up in the 1980s between an internal SACP in formation parts of the external SACP, I mean, outliers like Harold Wolpe and Ruth First, who were very much active, both academic as well as party participants in the new left and engagements with a left Eurocommunism, which became also very important inside of the SACP in the course of the 1980s, and in general had an important influence on the mass democratic movement.
COVID-19 is quickly circulating throughout the province of Quebec. It's essential that you get tested only if you have COVID-like symptoms. Symptoms such as fever, cough, and loss of taste or loss of smell. As you may already know, testing still remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. For more information, visit quebec.ca/test COVID-19. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
You're listening to Amandla here on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CQT.ca around the world. And as we like to remind you each week, please do check out the best of Amandla on our blog, which is amandla.ca.
Yes, Gwen. Sunday, December 12th, Guerrilla Toronto organized a panel called China-Africa Relations, Current State, Challenges and Perspectives. It was moderated jointly by Guerrilla Toronto, one of the organizers, Guerrilla, the Group for Research and Initiatives for the Liberation of Africa, and the International Manifesto Group. Take a look at their website. It's very interesting what they're about. But this particular panel I found so interesting that we've decided to play over the next 3 weeks, parts and excerpts from it, because I think it's so important for us to be informed about that relationship. It's going to be the future of what's going on Africa, a very important part. So I'll let Ahmet introduce the next speaker, and we'll carry on from there.
I'm going to move straight to Abayomi Asikiwe, who is the editor of the Pan-African Newswire, which is an international electronic press service on the affairs of African people throughout the world. Abayomi is a regular contributor to different newsletters or radio programs in North America. You have the mic, Abayomi. Mr. Abayomi.
Thank you so much. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to all the panelists and the viewing audience. My presentation is going to deal briefly with four areas that are pertinent to how we view Africa-China relations in the 21st century. I'd like to start off talking about the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation, FOCAC. I want to discuss some aspects of the recent visit by the United States Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, to three African states. also the whole concept of democracy, the Western concept, the Chinese concept, and also how the concept of international solidarity relates to Africa-China relations. A ministerial summit, in fact, the eighth ministerial summit of the Forum on China and Africa Cooperation, FOCAC, was held just several weeks ago in Dakar, Senegal, in West Africa. It was designed to reinforce the continuing bonds between Beijing and the 55-member African Union. 53 states on the continent have relations with China. Outside of Eswatini, formerly known as Swaziland, and of course the SADR, the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, which is not a sovereign state, although it is recognized by the African Union and the United Nations. FOCAC was formed in 2000 during an important period, which was marked by several years of substantial economic growth on the continent of Africa and in the People's Republic of China. Concurrently, over the same last two decades, the United States, Britain, the European Union, and their allies globally have been embroiled in numerous imperialist interventions, which have resulted in destabilizations, military interventions, proxy wars, and the expansion of the presence of the Pentagon and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization forces throughout Africa, Asia, and Latin America. These imperialist endeavors aimed at maintaining the political and economic domination of the world's population has created enormous difficulties for peoples globally, including the working class and the nationally oppressed and the overall impoverished living in the Western capitalist countries as well. Successive administrations in the United States and Britain have turned away, even rhetorically, from any notion of multilateralism, a reliance on the United Nations to resolve tensions and conflicts as well. They have created the conditions for widespread displacement internationally. The migration crisis in North Africa, the Mediterranean, which is extended into Southern, Central, and Western Europe, is a direct result of a series of wars and their aftermaths in countries such as Libya, Mali, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Haiti, to name the most well-known and the most devastating. The 21st century has witnessed U.S.-instigated regime change in numerous states, while the socialist states, such as the People's Republic of China, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Cuba, Venezuela, et cetera, have not embarked upon any destabilization efforts, let alone invasions into other sovereign states. Due to the socialist economic planning and their advancement of the notions of international cooperation and peace among states with varying social systems, there has been tremendous progress in the areas of international solidarity. Another example is the Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa grouping, BRICS. It is a manifestation of the role of Beijing, Moscow, and Pretoria, along with other states, which have had varying, which has varied in regard to their political orientation in recent years. These new alliances are perceived as a threat to the role of the United States, Britain, and the European Union, since they are not participant members and cannot directly impact the agendas and goals established by FOCAC and BRICS. With specific reference to the structures and objectives of FOCAC, the website of FOCAC says the following. The FOCAC follow-up mechanisms are built at three levels. The ministerial conference is held every 3 years. The senior officials' follow-up meetings and the senior officials' preparatory meetings for the ministerial conference are held respectively in the year and a few days before the ministerial conference is held. And the consultations between the African Diplomatic Corps in China and the Secretariat of the Chinese Follow-Up Committee are held at least twice a year, The ministerial conference and the senior officials meeting are held alternatively in China and an African country, with China and the African host being co-chairs presiding over the meetings and taking the lead in implementing the outcomes of the meetings. The ministerial conference is attended by foreign ministers and ministers in charge of international cooperation, and the senior officials meeting by director general levels and officials of the accompanying departments of China as well as African countries. At a recent 8th ministerial meeting of FOCAC in Senegal, a myriad of issues were discussed, including trade, investment, climate change, the COVID-19 pandemic, along with the distribution and manufacturing of vaccines. The gathering in Senegal coincided with the publication of a white paper by the Chinese government on China-Africa cooperation. Now, I want to move up to discuss the State Department, which deployed Antony Blinken in a failed attempt to weaken the FOCAC conference. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited 3 African states during November. It was done in many regards to attempt to counteract the impact of FOCAC. Blinken traveled to Kenya in East Africa, Senegal in West Africa, the location of the FOCAC conference, and the Federal Republic of Nigeria, which is the most populous state on the African continent. Objectively, no serious observer could argue that the foreign policy of the current President Joe Biden differs fundamentally from his predecessor, Donald J. Trump, in reference to the African Union member states. This lack of even a slight shift in policy towards Africa is reflected in the current conflict in the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia, where Washington is backing a rebel group, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, which previously was the leading force in the country's government prior to 2018. So, of course, coincided with the U.S. chief envoy's trip to Africa, the talking points claiming Chinese debt traps, which have been touched on earlier, surfaced in the corporate media. Both Chinese and African officials dismiss such characterizations of the relations between the two geopolitical regions. I'd also like to touch on the concept of democracy, the U.S. versus China. There was also a white paper issued in China explaining the concepts of democratic governance embodied within the program of the Communist Party, distinguishing its definition from what prevails in the United States. The U.S. promotes itself as the citadel of world democracy, placing human rights as a cornerstone of its foreign policy. This white paper entitled China Democracy That Works, which suggests that the Western forms of democracy have extreme deficiencies. We can look at the worsening economic conditions in the United States. This has served to inflame already existing social contradictions within the society. The country, the United States, was founded on the seizure of lands of the indigenous people. They were forcefully removed. There was mass extermination of the indigenous people in the United States as well. Even today, the indigenous people are largely relegated to reservations where many have been subjected to dangerous intrusions into their territories by multinational energy corporations that poison the soil and the water resources. As far as the descendants of African people are concerned, even though the Civil War ended 156 years ago, after nearly 2.5 centuries of enslavement under Spain, Britain, France, and the Netherlands within North America, there is widespread state-sponsored racism across the country where people are often impeded, harassed, arrested, prosecuted, falsely imprisoned, and even killed by law enforcement personnel. To conclude, I just wanted to mention that China and Africa have similarities in their historical development, being post-colonial geopolitical regions seeking to reaffirm their places within an international community of nations and peoples. China, under socialist construction, has moved within a reachable distance to surpass the United States in economic status. The main differences is that the U.S. built its wealth on the expropriation of indigenous land and the enslavement of Africans. During the mid-19th century, Mexico had huge swaths of this territory stolen by Washington under the guise of manifest destiny. In this period, the people of Mexico, Central America, South America, and the Caribbean are being blocked, incarcerated in federal detention facilities, and deported from the United States on a routine basis. People in North America must not be misled into taking a hostile position towards China and the burgeoning conflict between Washington and Beijing. The role of FOCAC and other structures guiding China-Africa cooperation should be studied as a model for greater international solidarity among working and oppressed people across the globe. Thank you so much once again for the invitation to participate in this webinar.
Thank you so much, Mr. Abiyomi Azikiwe. The next presenters, we have a joint presentation by two people, Jan Herong and Barry Saltman. They will do a joint presentation, so they may have a little bit longer time, maybe around 15 minutes. Jan Herong is the author of New Masters, New Servants, Migration, Development, and Women Workers in China. She's also co-author of East Mountain Tiger, China, Africa, and the West and Colonialism in Africa. She teaches at Hong Kong Polytechnic University. Barry Saltman is a professor at Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. He's a specialist in international law, particularly in its application to Africa-China relations. He's a co-author with Jan Herong of East Mountain Tiger, West Mountain Tiger, China, Africa, the West, and Colonialism in Africa. So the floor is yours.
Thank you.
Barry, I'll just wait for your screen sharing.
Can you see it? Sorry. Hello?
Hello, yes, we can hear you, but we can't hear.
Well.
Right. Okay.
Sorry?
Right. My internet is not very stable, so I just lost the connection. Let me turn off my video. Sorry. Excuse me for just, you're going to hear just my voice. Since mid-2000, the question we're going to deal with, Barry and I, will be on the whether China practices colonialism in Africa. Of course, our answer is no. Since mid-2000s, Western politicians and media have alleged China practices neo-colonialism in Africa. Their claims play on misunderstandings or reductionist understandings of modern colonialism, such as that colonialism can be reduced to one transnational imbalance. For example, colonialism is present where one country trades its manufactured goods for another country's primary products. A colonialist label is attached to China in order to displace criticisms of Western powers, both of their colonial legacies and of current neoliberal policies that Western entities impose on Africa. This label reflects not the reality, but Western elites' perception that they face a global struggle with a formidable competitor, China. While the colonialist label has no basis, Chinese companies in Africa still may behave much like those from other countries, reproducing some of the problems of the current global system. It is worth noting that Western political elites mainly talk positively about their own history of colonialism. British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher was such a defender. In 1988, she stated, "The story of how Europeans explored and colonized, and yes, without apology, civilized much of the world, is an extraordinary tale of talent, skill, and courage." Tony Blair of the Labour Party had a similar view. In 1997, he stated, "There's a lot of rubbish talked about the empire. In my view, we should not either be apologizing for it or wringing our hands about it. It was in many ways a most extraordinary achievement. France's parliament passed a law in 2005 that demanded that schools teach that French colonialism was beneficial, especially in North Africa. U.S. President George Bush Jr. had one time also, Barry, it's the wrong page.
No, it's the next page.
Okay, give me the next page. Claims that colonialism civilized the natives included persistent conservative justification of slavery as needed to transform savage Africans. They accord with the common white man's burden assumption that subjugated peoples were backward and incapable of creating industry, good governance, and a culture that serves their own good. For example, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has stated that British planted coffee, cotton, tobacco in Uganda, but if left to their own devices, the natives would have relied on nothing but bananas. U.S. President George W. Bush in 2000 positively analogized the U.S. conquest of Iraq to U.S. colonization of the Philippines. And some U.S. writers in 2000 also said the U.S. should recolonize parts of the developing world, especially in Africa and the Middle East. One such example is liberal U.S. journalist William Pfaff, who argued in the leading journal, Foreign Affairs, that because there's a lack of civil society in much of Africa, therefore Africa, he argued, one could call for a disinterested neocolonialism. Since late 1980s, across the political spectrum in the US, there has been a moral condemnation of the global South, and it is linked to vindication of colonialism to boost the moral credibility of the West. Most definitions, so from here on, I'm going to discuss characteristics of modern colonialism to set up a comparative framework. So in the second part, Barry can discuss Chinese practices in Africa. Most definitions of colonialism capture only one aspect of what is distinctive about it. And many definitions confuse colonialism with empire, dependency, or settlement, with transnational political influence, or with disadvantageous trade and investment. And based on our own study of the cases, colonialism involved a degree of control of economic and political development that is inconceivable in informal independencies. It included a complete loss of sovereignty and often almost total exclusion from power of local elites. So our definition is that colonialism is a relationship in which alien Western and Japanese rulers in subdued overseas lands practiced exclusionary authoritarian rule, imposed explicit racial hierarchy, enriched metropolitan and colonizing elites by monopoly exploitation of colonies' natural resources, labor and trade, and depleted, impoverished their native populations while often extirpating the cultures of the most vulnerable colonized peoples. The Polish-British writer Joseph Conrad, in his 1899 novel, The Heart of Darkness, called the ongoing final colonization of Africa the vilest scramble for loot that ever disfigured the history of human conscience. In 1770, the so-called economic backwardness was found only among only 10% of the world's population. 90% were on a roughly equal plane of development. Colonial mode exploitation, however, demanded that colonies could only import products from the colonizing metropoles and had to maintain very low or no tariffs. Colonial exports could only be made to metropoles from where they were often re-exported. Production of manufactured goods in the colonies that could compete with metropole products was banned. transport between colonies and metropoles or only on metropole ships. Such conditions, according to French historian Paul Béroge and Guinness historian Walter Rodney, led to a lack of diffusion of industrial revolution to the colonies or Africa's deindustrialization. Modern colonialism and slavery related to it produced demographic catastrophes in the colonized world, which also contributed to colonized people's de-development. So, but colonizing countries actually gained demographic reward of colonialism. So wealth from slave trade and colonies limited colonizing countries' immigration and
looks like your connection has dropped. Can proceed, well, maybe, Barry?
Yeah, I'll do that. So colonized countries gained demographic rewards from colonialism. Wealth from the slave trade and colonies limited colonizing countries' emigration and reduced their mortality rates. The principal colonies were supposed to provide monopoly profits for the colonialists. A 19th century French official in Algeria said that a colony's utility equals the total of profits and advantages that the metropole accrues. Unprofitable colonies were usually abandoned. The British Empire had 80% of colonized peoples, and during most of the colonial era was hugely profitable. Costs of colonialism were socialized, but profits went to bankers, traders, colonizers, and usually the state. According to Leo Goodstad, a leading historian of Hong Kong, the imperial tradition required colonial territories to invest their reserves in British and Commonwealth securities, to embrace the Sterling area's exchange controls to procure supplies through Crown agents in London, and to use commercial and technical standards from Britain. Until the 1970s, these imperial conventions served to direct business toward the United Kingdom and to restrict market opportunities for the rest of the world. Defense arrangements too appeared to provide Hong Kong with a British garrison at an unnecessarily high price. In Africa, native entrepreneurs were so restricted that they disappeared. Existing trade was destroyed in order to divert attention to producing export crops for European industries and importing European manufacturers. The growth of Africa's urban population stagnated at 10% in the colonial period, despite an influx of urban non-Africans, while the world's urban population grew from 9% in 1600 to 20% in 1900. Colonial rulers typically limited the amount and kind of investment by others. They curbed or banned native industries that competed with those of the metropole. They seized land and gave it to settlers. They redistributed the rural population and forced it to grow cash crops to better extract high and regressive taxes to finance their administration. Natives in modern colonies have been politically subordinate to colonizers. Discrimination was exceptionally harsh in Africa, but systematic even in such colonies as Hong Kong and the U.S.'s possessions. Power resided with the governor and his expatriate lieutenants in Hong Kong, for example. Top bureaucrats were from the metropole. In Hong Kong, the British governor appointed all members of governing institutions from 1842 until indirect elections were staged in 1985. And almost no Chinese served in government until after World War II. In Hong Kong, British judges punished Chinese defendants much more severely than Western defendants. In many colonies, communication with the government had to be in the colonial language. In Macau, for example, legal documents were only in Portuguese, the language of 2% of residents. The imported church was privileged. The Catholic Church in Macau represented 6% of the population, but was in charge of schooling the natives. Few colonized people were accorded citizenship. No colonies in their heyday gave natives rights equal to those of the colonialists. according to Osterhammel, a famous scholar of colonialism, the split of colonial law into one set of laws for foreigners and another for natives sometimes led to a blatant double standard of justice according to race, especially in settler colonies such as Algeria, where there was an especially harsh and demeaning code indigena for the Algerians. A double standard of justice was also found in exploitation colonies such as Japanese Taiwan. In Africa, the medical establishment was almost exclusively for the benefit of the European population. In Britain's colony of Sierra Leone, 3% of children attended school. The percentage was even lower in such British colonies as Gambia and northern Nigeria. Inequality was everywhere in the colonies. Resistance to colonialism was met with ferocious extra-legal repression. More than 100,000 Kikuyu in Kenya died, many by hangings and torture in concentration camps where Britain fought anti-colonial rebels from 1952 to 1960. As many as 1 million Algerians were killed from 1954 to 1962 when the French colonialists attempted to keep Algeria French. As Jonathan Krieghaus, a development analyst, has put it, by far the best colonial legacy was not to be colonized at all. Countries that avoided European colonization, as in select parts of Asia, frequently enjoyed highly efficacious states and societies, resulting in rapid economic growth. Indeed, colonialism was a catastrophe for the colonized. The same, however, cannot be said about China's practices in Africa.
And over? Now's the time to make your appointment for your booster dose against COVID-19. Visit quebec.ca/COVID vaccine to book your appointment online. To continue protecting yourself against COVID-19 and its variants, get a booster dose and keep following distancing measures, wearing a mask, and washing your hands. The booster dose, the best way to stay protected longer. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, this has been it for Amandla this week. We are happy to bring you these news and analysis that you will not find elsewhere on the media of mainstream Canada. And hopefully we'll be dispelling some of the myths that that very mainstream media has been pushing. So Gwen, what do you figure?
Well, listen, I have something in the pipeline for the new year, actually. It's an interview with Anuradha Mittal of the Oakland Institute. We have spoken to her and others at the Institute many times over the years. They're one of our go-to authorities around issues of resource control or loss of control, land grab and all of that. And they recently came out with a report, Stealth Game, Community Conservancies Devastate Land and Lives in Northern Kenya. And essentially, it reveals the devastating impact of privatized and neocolonial wildlife conservation and safari tourism on indigenous pastoralist communities. So they really do great work around that kind of stuff. They demystify what most people see as very benign institutions and indicate that they're actually part of a neo-colonial continuum. So she's a great interview. We can look forward to hearing what she has to say early in January. So just to give you a little bit of a taste of what's to come.
Stay tuned for Jazz Euphorium.
Africa United!
Are you age 65 and over? Now's the time to make your appointment for your booster dose against COVID-19. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to book your appointment online. To continue protecting yourself against COVID-19 and its variants, get a booster dose and keep following distancing measures, wearing a mask, and washing your hands. The booster dose, the best way to stay protected longer. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Hello, my name is Alia. I'm at CQOT in Montreal, 90.3 FM. Keep on rocking in the free world.
Keep on rocking the free world. Keep on rocking the free world.
Hubert Eves is our pianist, Hubert Eves. Hubert Eves comes from St. Paul, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Howard King is our drummer, Howard King. And he comes from the Bronx, New York. Oh, we got a hand for the Bronx, huh? Okay. Our bassist is Stafford James from Evanston, Illinois. Time we'd like to wish everybody peace and love and peace and health.